The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Hi, I watched you trying to sneak some of that brandy in there when I wasn't looking. Real sneaker. No, not you. I know what you're drinking there, Mr. Moonshine. What's on your head, Lemmy?
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and let's get the weekend started with the patented, here we go, Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan calling you. Hey, listen, I went and saw my doctor yesterday. He diagnosed me with hypochondria. I said, not that too. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
I like that one. Stacy said she didn't get it. He's got hypochondria, which means he thinks you have every disease. I saw my doctor last week. He diagnosed me with hypochondria, and the guy said, not that too. So I like that one. And I love Duff for sending them in every single Friday, even when he's on tour, which he's about to be again as they're hitting the road next week, Guns N' Roses in South America, starting September 1st. And then they're going to Mexico, Asia, and ending the year in Australia and New Zealand. And they are drawing huge crowds. As always, it's Guns N' Roses, so playing better than ever. And Fozzy also playing better than ever, getting ready to hit the road again as well. The Save the World Tour continues September 8th in Columbus, Ohio, at the King of Clubs. And we're crisscrossing the States, headed to Canada for a couple gigs in Toronto and Montreal. FozzyRock.com has all the dates and ticket information, along with the details on our legendary, supremely popular VIP meet and greets. We're also headed back to Europe in November. We start in Manchester on November 4th. We hit Birmingham, Nottingham, Dublin, Belfast, Swansea, Bournemouth, Bristol, Glasgow, London, basically Wales, Scotland, Ireland, Northern Ireland, England. We are going everywhere. So come check us out there and come check us out in Australia and New Zealand. We are going to be there on November 28th in Auckland. And we got shows in Brisbane, Melbourne, Sydney, and Adelaide with Buck Cherry. Come rock with us this fall, FozzyRock.com for all the info and ticket details and VIP details. And come watch us rock and come listen to us rock. And stay here to listen to Dave Mustaine, the leader of Megadeth, the legendary Dave Mustaine, returning to Talk is Jericho. They have a new album coming out. It's called The Sick, The Dying, and The Dead. It drops next Friday, September 2nd, but it's available for pre-order now at the official Megadeth store, iTunes, Amazon Music, and wherever you buy music. I put a link on the show description for easy access. It is a great album. I've been spending a lot of time with it lately, really enjoying it. Dave and I talk about what it was like for him to make this record while undergoing treatment for throat cancer during a pandemic. Think about that. Radiation, chemotherapy, lockdown. He gets very candid about what the experience was like, how his battle with cancer changed his life, his music, and his unique singing voice, and why he feels that he is a vocalist, not a singer. We talk about Kiko Larrero from Angra joining Megadeth on guitar. I'm a huge Angra fan, of course, obviously a huge Megadeth fan. He's been there for a few years, and how that's been for Dave and the guys to acclimate to him. Plus, Dave shares some stories about Metallica's early days, rooming with James Hetfield, touring with Exciter, Canada's own Exciter, getting rides from Cliff Burton to and from Metallica rehearsals. What exactly Dave contributed to a Metallica song that Cliff taught him from Lynyrd Skynyrd. You're going to hear about that. Never heard that story before. Dave's also a black belt in karate and taekwondo and working toward his black belt in Gracie Barra jiu-jitsu. Dave's sensei travels with the band when they tour. We talked about that as well and a whole multitude of other subjects. Great to talk to Dave Mustaine. Always a good guy to talk to, and my friend. And he's here. He's back on Megadeth, right here on Talk Is Jericho. The sick, the dying, and the Dave. Mustaine returns to TIJ here and now. All right. So it's been a long time since I saw Dave Mustaine. And in the midst of doing press, you had to take a 30-second break in between interviews here. Is this something that you enjoy doing? Is it a necessary evil? Are you excited about doing all the talking about the record?
Well, first off, hello to all of your listeners and viewers. And it's so great to see your face. And I'm actually really fond of our friendship. It's really cool to see you and catch up.
Me too, man. Absolutely.
When I get a chance, you know, I don't know, you know, it's we have so many, many, many interviews right now because of the nature of this new record. I've wanted to do this record for a while, and the music's been in me. It just hasn't really surfaced. A lot of it had to do with lineup. A lot of it had to do with label. A lot of it had to do with me. So I think I've done a lot of introspection after I got sick, and made me look at everything. You know, you got a lot of time sitting there reflecting and thinking about things, thinking about people, thinking about, you know, what you would like to do with the time you have left. And that giant question, how much time do you have left? So right. I think it's made me a better person. I think it's made me a little bit more, I don't know. If you've seen any of the interviews as of late, there's a different kind of tone, I guess, that I'm feeling. There's a different vibration I'm feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, they talk about Tesla and about how, I think you guys play detuned, but back when we were playing in A440, the frequency 440 was supposed to have been a frequency that they tuned their instruments to. For your listeners that don't know what I'm talking about, the second string on the guitar, not the fattest one, but the second fattest one, is an A, and it needs to vibrate at 440 vibrations per second, I think it is, or minute or something. And the true frequency was supposed to have been 432. And that's what real classical symphonies tuned to, is 432. And if you look on the internet right now, there's a rage going around about listening to healing frequency. They're really getting into infrared stuff, light healing, sound healing, and it's marvelous. It's really, really interesting. Now, of course, I wouldn't tune my guitar to 432 because it's we're already tuned down to D because of the plate I have in my neck from the cancer, from the fusion. Excuse me.
Right.
Different surgery.
A true heavy metal warrior for sure.
Bunch of used parts.
So you're tuned to that for vocal reasons then? Is that what you're saying? Because of the plate that you have?
No, we to D, yes.
Yes.
Because my range, I can hit the high notes, but it sounds terribly strained. And I'm not a singer. I'm more of a vocalist. You know, I kind of tell stories a little bit more with melody, and as opposed to someone like, say, a Rob Halford or a Sean Harris, you know, the guy from Diamond Head,
sure,
or a Bruce Dickinson, you know, some of the people that sing. Mm. I listen to people like Sting singing, and I think, if only, you know, if I could sing like that, what would it sound like? You know, would I have sang in Metallica? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
I know James wanted to be the singer for a long time, but, you know, there were times when Lars and James had fights, and not for nothing, you know, just saying, if I had been singing the whole time, I don't know where I would be or what I would be doing.
Well, it's interesting when you talk about your voice, is something I was going to bring up. It's like, it really is so unique. And if you showed up on The Voice or American Idol, you would not last, you know, 5 minutes. But like you said, you're like, you know, like Ozzy is like this, or a Bob Dylan is like this, where there's such a personality and uniqueness to the voice. Nobody sounds like Dave Mustaine.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that you're a vocalist, not a singer.
Right.
What is the difference for that for you?
Well, I think if you're vocalizing something, you're basically speaking something with a pitch to it. And maybe you're talking a little bit higher or something. For example, people that come from Canada have their sentences and an up note.
What you're talking
Americans
about,
eh? Sentences on a down note.
Right.
And I think a lot of that has to do with the splitting of the country and the colonization of Canada, that they embraced that part where the sentences end on the up note. A lot of European will ask questions and it goes up on the end. What are you doing today? Hey, would you like me to rip that Band-Aid off your head?
Right.
Imagine if everybody did that when they talked. They vocalized when they talked. Everything was a song of sorts. There has been a couple songs, Chris, I know, because we've known each other for so long that you know the ones I'm talking about. But there are songs like A Tout Le Monde where I tried to sing a little bit more. Going Home. Coming Home, whatever the name of that song is. I can't even remember anymore.
Coming Home, yeah.
Songs. Yeah. I never struggled. You know, I said something to the singer from Pantera one time that I liked the song Cemetery Gates. We were on tour with Pantera. For some reason, you know, it was the last show. We were in Holland, I think it was. And they said, do you have a song you want us to play for you? And I said, yeah, Cemetery Gates. They hadn't played it all tour.
Okay.
And so I said, Cemetery Gates. And they did it. And I think the guy's got a really good voice for singing. And I think that sometimes when you go down a road, sometimes you can't go back.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can. For me, I've always tried to make sure everyone knew if I took both of my feet off first base, I was either getting to second base or I was going to play one of the most deadly games of pickle you've ever seen in your life.
So how was your voice affected? So talking with Bruce Dickinson 5-6 years ago when he had tongue cancer, mm-hmm. he said when he finally came back to sing, he had a lot of issues with the saliva in his throat and that sort of a thing. And obviously his voice now is maybe better than ever, at least in the modern era. How did the throat cancer affect your voice and how were you able to adapt to it and come back to singing full throttle?
Same thing. I have issues with my voice, with saliva. See, I think what happens is when your head goes inside of that radiation chamber, there are certain things inside of your body that is not going to survive. And you're hoping that you push the envelope to the brink of death of the organ until it's had enough. And then you stop and you let it convalesce back to normal health. For me, fortunately, a lot of the stuff that was damaged is coming back. My memory was totally foobar. And I'm starting
really?
To stop. Yeah, I would be in the middle of a conversation. And I have to ask the people that I love that are around me to help me because of, you know, what happened with all of the radiation. And the chemo was gnarly, too. I had a lot of chemo, too. I'll be talking about something, and sometimes, depending on what part of the day it is, I'll just be tired or the medication will catch up with me, and I'll forget what I'm talking about. I'll get on a tangent because I have so many stories I want to tell. We'll be talking about something, and I'll think, oh, yeah, and then it's like, oh, shit, I forgot what I was saying. You know?
Right. You have a metal heart, too?
Spiders. Now my nipples get hard around you, Chris. You know that.
Of course, nothing's changed, Dave.
Nothing's changed.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Dave, like you mentioned, when you come, obviously, you hear the word cancer, you know, all of us were worried about you. But was it something that was, how bad did it get? I mean, was it something that was always manageable? It seemed like you kind of got through it. But I mean, were you like completely screwed all across the board, or was it something where the treatment took care of it instantly?
It didn't take care of it instantly. It took time. You know, there was obviously stuff that body takes time. I mean, you're an extreme athlete. You know, when you get hurt, you know, your hurts, your aches and pains are nothing compared to an average human because you're an elite athlete and your body has been conditioned to block out a lot of the typical pain. Most people would experience a stubbed toe and say, ow, you know, you have to have your toe broken.
Right.
Because your pituitary gland is like a full-on charging rhino. you know, versus other people who don't put their bodies through that kind of a rigorous workout. And, you know, I'm doing BJJ, sure, but I don't exercise as hard as you do because I'm not competing.
Right.
But, you know, the probably the worst part about the cancer treatment was the side effects. The cancer, we caught it early. You know, we were able to deal with it without having to go under the knife. But it was still trying, and it took its toll on my family because all the different medications, you know, you have to take this one for nausea and that one for pain, and this one's for nausea from the pain, and this one's from pain from the nausea stuff, right. And then this one helps you sleep, and that one helps you stay awake, and this one makes it so that you don't piss your pants, and this one makes it so that you can go pee, and, you know, and you're thinking like, half of these, if I stop taking them, I don't need the other ones, right?
So right.
It's just crazy. And eating was hard. You know, I didn't have much of an appetite. And they said if I didn't eat, I was going to get a feeding tube. And I said, there's no freaking way I'm getting a feeding tube. So I ate as much as I could. And when we were recording the record, we had the luxury of having someone run and get our food for us. So I was able to eat what I had a last minute craving for.
Right.
Unlike when you're at home and, you know, you open up the fridge and you figure, well, what's there? How can I make myself satiated with what's here versus, you know what, I think I'm going to have a left-handed banana or something ridiculous like that. You know, looking back in hindsight, it could have been way worse. I think if I didn't have the support system I had, that it would have been worse.
It's great because there's a note on We'll Be Back, a high scream that is very Halford-esque. And I've never heard you sing like that before, Dave. It's right during the solo, right before the solo. And it's like, wow, that was a hell of a note. Is that something that you just said, fuck it, I'm going to go for it? I've never heard you sing like that before.
I must have got hurt while I was singing because I don't remember it.
Maybe it's a guitar solo sound. I don't know. To me, it sounded like a big high scream.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, honestly, Chris, the record's so fresh in my mind and I was undergoing so much challenge from the number one challenge, you know, making the record was kind of like a hobby while I was trying to save my voice. And because I kept thinking they're going to take a chunk of my tongue out. You know, I'd heard that about Sir Edward and,
right.
You know, I mean, he didn't sing in Van Halen. So, I mean, granted, it must be terrible to be a person and have part of your tongue removed. But that wasn't the case. I didn't lose my hair, lost a little bit of weight, had two bad days of getting sick. That was it. You know, I had days where I did throw up, but there was only 2 days where I had bad days of throwing up. Mm-hmm. And everything else was, you know, easy peasy. I think a lot of it had to do too, Chris, from being out on the road and getting food poisoning as much as we do with some of the terrible stuff that we have to eat. And, you know, the famous line that John said in Dead or Alive, you know, sometime you tell the day by the bottle that you drink, mm-hmm. you know. And I don't know if you're a drinker, if you ever were, or if you still do. And that's how I used to tell my day, you know, where we're at the time, how many bottles you had drank, you know, where you were at, how you were dealing with stuff, because it was that kind of a living. You were basically, you know, homeless, and the only difference between you and a real hobo was you weren't in a boxcar, you were in a camper.
Right.
And when we first went out touring and we were out with Exciter, I just talked to Dan just recently. I don't know if you're friends with him or not.
Did you?
Well, I didn't talk to Dan Beeler. I talked to his new member, but Dan and I were really close. We were so poor in the beginning with Megadeth, and we did this tour with them. We supported them. Gar had gone out to go try and score some smack, and he got delayed, whatever. I think what happened was he connected and he got delayed.
right.
So it's time for us to go on. No Gar. Dan's getting hot, right? No Gar. It's going, clicking away. Another 10 minutes, another half hour. He goes, okay, A, I got to play now. I'm not happy about this. And I went, no. So they play. Gar shows up. And Dan was gracious enough, which was really cool because he was still the headliner, to let us play after him. And the thing that was most important that I coveted with Dan was he was kind of at the time because I was basically homeless. He was like the liquor cabinet for me and for Ellison because he drank White Russians all the time. And it was so, so typical. We'd go over there and you would hear this on the camper door that they were traveling in, and he'd go, "Hello," beautiful quiet. He'd go, "Hey, White Russians, come on, man, we're ready." Not a sound, right? Wait, I know you're in there. Come on, man. So that's how the tour was. After we would play, we would have White Russian parties with them all the time. That was a fun period in my life. I loved going up to Canada for that first time. It was beautiful.
Well, Canada, especially Eastern Canada, is such a heavy metal area. You know, even to this day.
Sure is. Yeah.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Well, you've been through so much. It's great hearing those early stories, and you're talking about now all those trials and tribulations you've been through. Has that changed your attitude? When I see you, there was a great thing on social media a few months ago where you go out into the crowd
and
you gave a little kid a pick, and it's like secret Dave Mustaine, that kind of shuffle walk that you're doing with your hoodie on. It's like, I don't envision Dave 10, 15 years doing that, which is amazing.
You don't envision me doing that?
I don't envision you doing that maybe 10, 15 years ago. Maybe you did, but to see that now, it's just like it looked like a whole new mindset for you.
Yeah, I've always been cool to little kids, you know, and I've tried really hard to just do what's not normal. You know, the norm is to be, you know, hard ass and not to kids, you know, not to women, you know, not to old people. You know, if it's a bro and you can get away with giving him a Charlie horse, you know, that's okay. But if it's somebody who, and even in this situation, I didn't know if he knew who I was. Who the hell knows?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he knew who I was and that we had that little fun connection and watching his little brother go, "Who is this guy?" You know, it's not hard to go out of your way to make people happy in life. And I don't know how that affected him, how it's going to translate further on in his life. You know, he may end up being someone great in the music industry, all because Dave Mustaine came out and gave him a guitar pick.
Mm.
Going to be a guitar player? Well, who knows? He could be an attorney for entertainment. You know, he could be a super powerful magnet in a record label or in management. Who knows? Maybe he was somebody in class that digs numbers, and that just made his brain just go to a new level. You know, Einstein had said that humans use approximately 3 to 8% of their brain, and geniuses are the only ones who get up near the 8% level. And I thought, good God, Chris, could you even imagine what people would be like if they could use more than that 3%, or the geniuses that can get up to 8%. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, totally.
Think what things would be like. Cause I had seen this thing, you know, I'm a lot of people don't like me and that's okay. I say stuff that makes a lot of people uncomfortable. And I don't do that to make anybody mad. I like to bring things to the surface and have people find out for themselves the truth.
Hmm.
This is a lot of the stuff that, you know, we sang about in the beginning because it wasn't trendy. Trendy is a terrible word for anything associated with Megadeth. It was provocative.
Right. It was poignant. You've always had that lyrics that make people think a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
And this record too. I mean, there's a lot of lyrics on about war, I find, in this, you know. And obviously, you know, the first song, Sick, the Dying, the Dead, is probably, was it about the bubonic plague? Is about the Black Plague? I mean, there's a lot of history in the lyrics that you write.
Right.
And that's to educate, or that's what you enjoy writing about?
Metaphorically, Chris, I think, you know, Soldier On isn't about war. Yeah. Although it says soldier and it has a marching cadence at the end of it. It's a song about the inner conflict you have to make with a relationship, somebody that you know that it's bad for you. You know, if you love something so much that you're willing to walk away from it, there's something very inherently evil going on there. And my drug use was so rampant when a lot of the songs like Tornado of Souls was about me having to walk away from this relationship. Soldier On talks about this person who has gotten so enamored with this double life that they're living that now all of a sudden the road is his mistress and the stage is his wife. He doesn't care about his family. He doesn't care about children. He doesn't care about wife's commitments or anything. Wherever he's at, whatever it is that he's doing, you know, he could be a musician. He could be, you know, a proctologist for all I care. And you've got other songs like Life in Hell is another song that's very much like that. Mm-hmm. It could have come across as, an occult-like song. No, it's more, again, about the relationship stuff. Dogs of Chernobyl. Is it about meltdown? Well, it's about a relationship. Somebody leaves somebody on their ass, and they don't know what happened. Poof, they're gone. I watched that B-grade sci-fi flick on Chernobyl. It was a real schlocky movie. And I noticed one scene in there where these young kids had gone on this excursion out to Pripyat to go see Chernobyl. There were these dogs that were there, and people had said, you know, what's up with the dogs? And they said, well, when the evacuation order came, people just left, and they left their dogs behind. And I thought, well, this is pretty awful. Mm-hmm. And it left an impression on me, you know, that the person had to leave so fast that they just left their dogs, their everything. I mean, if we had to leave, we would obviously have to leave horses. We have two big horses and one miniature horse, so we'd have to leave them. We have very, very small dogs, so we may take them. But if they said no pets, we'd have to leave them, you know?
Yeah.
And decision to do that probably is really difficult, but the feeling that I imagined, I'm not one of those guys that wants to do, you know, some kind of shape-shifting or do some kind of crazy thought transference, you know, where I can think what it's like to be a dog. But just imagining what it would be like to have someone just gone, a whole city gone, everyone gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you've gone from being an indoor person to living outdoors now. And now you've got to forage for your food every day. Plus, you've got to face all the other dogs that want to kick your ass, take your food.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, that's...
So there's a lot more to some of these songs than what meets the eye. A lot of it's metaphorical. There's a couple songs. Killing Time is about some people in my life that I had endorsement with a long time ago that I had left. You know, if you look at it, Killing Time, for most people, they're going to think it's a song about execution.
Mm.
It's not. It's a song about procrastination.
Oh.
So right. Time is fleeting. It's not being killed. I'm saying you're killing my time. You're wasting my time.
Right.
So a lot of the titles that Megadeth uses with our songs have death in the word, in the title, or dying or something similar to that. But it doesn't always necessarily signify homicide or somebody losing their life.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
I love the sense of humor that you show sometimes in your songs. Obviously, this record is very fast at times. Great riffs, great guitar playing, as always. But I think in listening to it, this might be surprising. My favorite song that jumps out to me right now so far, amongst many, is Mission to Mars. And the reason why is it makes me smile. It makes me laugh when it's like, you know, 300 million miles isn't too far away. And then you go, yes, it is. Like, there's these little,
yeah.
It reminds me of,
can it take a light year or two?
Yeah, or three, you know, yeah. And like, that's fun. It reminds me of like 1,000 times goodbye, where there's these little kind of asides. And it's very much knowing you, you know, very much a Dave Mustaine style of just little sarcastic, little
snarky,
quips. Snarky.
Yeah.
But it's great. Like, it really does connect with me, and I'm sure with a lot of your fans, when you do those types of things.
Thanks. You're the only person who's mentioned that yet, Chris.
Really? It jumped right out to me the first time I heard it. I was like, what was that? Rewind it, you know?
Yeah.
Or scroll back, shall we say, in this day and age.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Did you know that we released cassettes on this thing?
Really?
And I had gotten the shipment from them that had these really awesome, awesome collector's item records. I'll send you one, the lenticular ones. You know the lenticular one, like the tool cover, that animal one where you flipped it back and forth and the guy rockered on his behind?
Yeah.
This is a lenticular one, but it's not like that. It's like one of the three-dimensional ones.
Mm.
And we did that for the disc. We've got a dual gatefold record with 180-gram German vinyl discs. And then we have the regular record that is just a single disc. But the double record has three songs per side. So the grooves are spaced out a lot. The fidelity on it is amazing. We also have a CD with the lenticular cover on it. And that has bonus tracks on it. It has Sammy Hagar's track from his solo career, This Planet's on Fire, which he graciously said he's going to jump up on stage with us when we play San Francisco this tour coming up here. I hope we get a chance to do it. I hope he's there, you know. I had mentioned something to Marty Friedman when we were playing in Japan coming up in February at Budokan. Would he play with us? And he said, yeah. And then he writes back the days that he's out of the country and he's not there. So, you know, all these years we've been waiting for the perfect opportunity to do a song together. You know, Budokan was a place that we were supposed to play together. It was something that Marty really loved. And sadly, at the time, we were unable to do that. We had a stint where the band was trying to get sobered up. And, you know, I had gone into treatment. And while I was there, the guy from Milli Vanilli was there. And the manager came and got him and took him out. And consequently, he died that tour. Mm. And I had been told while I was in the treatment center that, you know, when you get out of treatment, that you need to go and just chill. Mm. You need to get a support system, basically. So I was planning on going home, and we had an agent at the time named Andy Summers, and he booked us to go right after I got out of treatment to Japan. And I went, you're out of your mind. You need to cancel that. And I didn't think it was a big deal, but it was heartbreaking for Marty. This is the first time since that time back in 1992.
Jeez.
It's been 30 fucking years since that episode happened where we get a chance to play Budokan. And I talked to Marty, he was down for it, and then it's scheduling.
That would have been huge. That would have been huge for people. Yeah.
It would have been really cool. I asked him what song he wanted to play too, and he said Tornado. And Kiko's the only one that's played Tornado right besides Marty. You know, it's great to see how much emphasis the guitar world has put on that particular solo.
Mm.
You know, when you're writing a song, you never really know what's going to happen. You know, when we did my first book, I'm a best-selling author.
Yep.
And I had a book come out several years ago. It was my autobiography. And one of the things that the attorneys kept saying was, you got to make sure that you don't invade anybody's privacy. And I didn't really know how me telling my story would invade other people's privacy, but there were a lot of instances, and they're too long to go into, but there were a lot of instances whereby me telling my story would implicate somebody else or reveal something about somebody else that they don't necessarily want somebody to know.
Right.
Yeah, I was with my one friend, and he was a chronic toenail biter.
You can get sued for that.
Oh, my God.
You mentioned Marty, and then you mentioned Kiko. I've been an Anger fan since 1994. So when you brought Kiko Loureiro into Megadeth, it was a big deal. I was a big fan. And now it's two albums later, and he's actually helped write quite a few songs on this record. So
yeah,
the chemistry is there. The trust is there for you to take his riffs or whatever it was. I mean, obviously that's worked out hugely for Megadeth and for you to have him in the band.
Right. You know, with everybody, there's a learning curve.
Sure.
You know, I had to learn a lot about him, and he had to learn a lot about me. And one of the humorous sides about us trying to get Kiko into the Megadeth mindset, I asked them to read the lyric prior to playing the part. I said, it's important that you know the song is about so that you can meet out the proper amount of emotion, emoting and not knowing what the lyric is about. You have a frenetic solo over something that should be a little more somber. You've missed the plot.
Interesting.
So we were goofing around and I was working. It's a little video clip. I don't know if it's ever got to many people to see it, but we posted it a while ago, and I was sitting there and I'm looking like this right now up at the monitor on my Pro Tools rig, right? That face that you get, right? And Kiko's sitting next to me in a chair and he's whittling away on his guitar. I'm trying to do one of his solos. And he goes, "Hey Dave, I think I have a guitar, an idea for the solo." And I said, "Okay." And I look at him and he starts playing reggae. And he was fucking with me, of course, but I was in no mood at that moment for him to do that, right? So, you know, Kiko has a very playful nature. He's very much like a cat, you know, with the way that he kind of plays around with certain things. You know, I think the difference between dogs and cats are pretty obvious. Kiko's very cerebral with his thoughts. They're very calculated, and he's very much in his, I don't want to say his own world because that sounds disrespectful, but Kiko is very happy with his life and where he's going. You know, we all face challenges at every stage in our life, and this is no different than anybody else. Going out on a 2-month tour when you have a set of 5-year-old twins is challenging. But I think that the success of the record right now is setting the stage. And, you know, as things change for us with our careers, as we start to learn how to conduct ourselves as businessmen, start to put a little bit of money in the bank, start to get a car, get a house, you know, start to save some money and plan for the future. You know, those are things that are all happening right now with Kiko and Dirk. As you know, him being an Anger fan, he's been at this a long time. This is really great now because I told him when I first met him, I said, "Your life's going to change, man." I don't care how big you think Anger is, you know, because I liked Anger too. But I said, "You're going to go from being an Anger to being a star in Megadeth." And I said, "If you play your cards right, you'll end up being a superstar." Mm. You know, I've always tried to paint the picture of the dynamic, I think, with the band. You know, you sometimes, the success of a band is based on the makeup of the pyramid of the band. You know, you've got your marquee player, much like in hockey, you've got your goal scorer, your soak, as it will. And then you've got your B-grade players, usually your supporting cast, then your C-grade players, your defensemen, and then D-grade, which are your grinders, you know, your utility players. So,
right.
You know this more than I would, being Canadian and probably skated a lot as a youth. So you know the establishing that hierarchy around your franchise player is what the success of the team is built on. So when you have a band that's got, say, 4 guys, we'll keep it simple, and all 4 guys, they just play an instrument. They're not musicians. They just play instruments. They'll never make it. They'll never make it. So you have a band of 4 guys and they're all musicians. Will they make it? They'll probably be a really good cover band. If you have a band and you have 1 star in it, will you make it? Probably. But the other guys in that band won't be there when the smoke clears.
Mm-hmm.
If you have several stars in the band, it's a good chance they're going to stick together the whole time. And there's a good chance that you're going to go on to superstardom.
That makes sense.
If you're a superstar, you don't really need a band. You want a band sometimes. You find people you really like, but they don't always keep pace. And it's very much like being on a wagon train. You can't have an ox next to a horse. They're unevenly paired up, right?
Right.
I don't know if you've had to make any of those terrible things we call lineup changes.
Oh, plenty of them, yeah.
The worst part is when you have to make a lineup change with a friend. Like if you are playing in a band and you've put it together with high school mates and you have to say goodbye to somebody, that's always painful because usually the saying I've always said, if you get in the band with a friend, be prepared to lose both. I think, you know, when you have to say goodbye to those guys, a lot of times the friendship's over. So that's a caveat for young musicians to, if you hire somebody based on their ability to play, then you don't ever have to explain to anybody why you've got a bad bass player.
Right.
Well, he's dating my sister. Well, great, but he sucks. Can't even play bass and confused.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
With Megadeth being such a guitar-driven band, and you being one of the best guitar players, not just in metal, but in rock and roll history, in my opinion, is it difficult when you have to get a new guitar player, you know, from Chris Boland to Jeff Young to Broderick, now with Kiko, to learn the new style? Do they have to connect with you? Do you have to connect with them? Does it take a while to kind of get that blending?
Sometimes. They're all different animals.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it had to do where they were centered. You know, if it was Megadeth centric, then everything would be great. If they were self-centered, then it wouldn't work, because Megadeth is a band. Although people identify me as being Megadeth, I go out on stage with a supporting cast that's my bandmates, and they sing and they solos.
Sure.
So I look at Megadeth as being a band, and I'm the leader of it, but I know I couldn't do it on my own. Having said that, are there times in history where there were better guitar players than others? Yes, numerous times. Where an example, we'll use the drumming area, because that's a fairer way to explain this. Having a jazz drummer with Gar and then going to a punk rock drummer with Chuck was a dramatic change. Mm. And the songs, had the songs on So Far So Good So What been recorded by Gar, it would be a totally different record. Mm. Completely different record. And the person that we used to record that album was a guy named Paul Annie. I think he did us a pretty terrible disservice recording that record, because he had Chuck record the songs on drums with no cymbals.
Hmm.
So he played the whole drum set with no cymbals. And then when it was time to do the cymbals, he came back after the fact and played the cymbals.
Really?
Very, very strange. He said that he did that for separation. And, you know, I couldn't see the merit in doing that. And it wasn't long until I let him go.
Because his way of recording just didn't jibe with yours, right?
Well, I never heard that before. I had heard that Peter Gabriel had done the War Without Tears record without cymbals. The whole record didn't have cymbals on it, from what I heard, if I remember right. Do you know that one song?
Yeah.
If looks can kill, they probably will, with days without frontiers.
Yeah, War Without Frontier. Yeah.
Yeah. So no cymbals on that record. That's why front of house guys use that to tune the PAs so many times when you go in concert. If you're there early and you're hearing the front of house engineers tune the PA for the upcoming bands, they'll use that track because there's no high-end white noise coming off of the track from the cymbals. I know you know this, but sure. I don't know that for any of your listeners would know that. And there's always interesting stuff to learn, you know, when you and I talk. I learn stuff about you. You learn stuff about me. And there's always stuff about the industry that we talk about that most people wouldn't hear.
You know? I wanted to ask you another question along those lines on the We'll Be Back sure. video. It's a great clip. On the beach, there's a big violent fight. It's a very almost Saving Private Ryan fight to the death, but it's almost like the origin of the See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Speak No Evil, Vic Rattlehead.
Vic was about See No Evil, Speak No Evil, and Hear No Evil. My mom used to sell imported junk. She would get stuff from these magazines, and I don't know what she was thinking, because she lived in an apartment about the size of a one-car garage, and it had two little bedrooms that were about the size of two Volkswagen garages. That was the size of the whole apartment. Mm-hmm. Hetfield lived there with me when we lived together at the end of Metallica. Once we let Ron McGovney go, James had to move out. So he moved down there with me in that place. And, you know, my mom would have this stuff. So she by no means was a distributor of anything. She had like a couple shoeboxes of junk she was trying to sell people, and had that one little thing, three monkeys, you know.
Yeah. Seen over here and over here. Yeah.
And so that was kind of like what I took with me through life, you know, do the right thing to others, treat them the way that you want to be treated. See no evil, speak no evil, hear no evil. And you know what? You'll get through life. And by the time I had gotten to be an adult, I had pretty much simplified it. And I had said something to someone when they had asked me about, you know, what I had hoped for my son. I said, you know, I have only two things. I hope that he will at some point in his life read the Bible. And I hope that he's a black belt in a martial arts style, because he'll have all the wisdom he needs, and he'll know how to take care of himself, and he'll be able to pursue any line of work that he wants to do if his heart's right. I'm very proud of both of my kids. I think that they've done really well. A lot of people thought that my kids would end up being, my son would be Keith Richards and my daughter would be, you know, like Nancy Spungen or whatever, Spurgeon, whatever her name was. But yeah, I've been really blessed in that area. You know, having a strong wife really had a big part to do with that.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com, to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Last few things, Dave, as we start to wind down. I noticed, too, once again, you guys do a lot of jiu-jitsu on the road. Do you have a sensei, a teacher that travels with you so you can work out during the day?
Yeah, he's a fourth degree black belt in Gracie Baja jiu-jitsu. I've been training with him for a couple of years. I'm getting ready to have another test coming up, which it's great for me because, you know, I'm learning two different angles because of all my other martial art background. I'm learning the Olympic style, and I'm also learning, you know, self-defense style, which is a little different. You know, the moves are in self-defense, they're obviously, you know, you're defending yourself, life or death kind of thing. And the Olympic one is where you're just going for points and stuff like that. So learning the history, I had to learn when I got my black belt in Aikido-kan with Benny the Jet. I had to learn about him, about Native Americans, about his career. That's how I fell in love with the guy. He was just such an amazing hero. And when I got my second black belt in Sangam, I had to write an essay on Korea, which was interesting. So, you know, I just didn't go into some place and just go to a multi-level marketing martial art place and go buy a black belt. It's been a lifelong process since I was 12. Professor Reggie trains me. He trains Kiko. He trains my son. Several of our crew train with him. It's just a fun environment because the guys in Five Finger Death Punch have their trainer out with them too. When we were out with Trivium, the singer for Trivium had his trainer out. So there's a lot of people that do BJJ, and there's not really that big of a difference between Gracie and some of the other jiu-jitsu schools. I like Gracie because there are 900 schools. I like it because it's consistent training from one school to another. I like the fact that when you go in there, you don't hear the our style is better than your style stuff. They used to do that in the beginning, but I don't have to deal with that. That's one of the things that usually makes me know I'm in the wrong place, when you go in there and the guy's saying his style is better than anybody else's, because you know what? A gun is going to eliminate your style in one click. I went to a school up in Canada where George St. Pierre trained, and I was so thrilled, Chris. It was so awesome. You know, I don't know if you know him personally, but
I don't.
I'm a big fan of his. He's classy like you are. And I've noticed that the UFC is starting to do a little bit more of the drama stuff, mm-hmm. a little bit more following in line with what you guys are doing mm-hmm. With the backstory. I've never heard anything that he did. I do know that the TV show that they have now with the UFC does a lot of that backstory stuff and trying to build, you know,
sure, the characters,
rivalries and stuff. Yeah. Yeah. But he was a guy I dug. Like when I first saw Connor, I dug him. And then towards the end, so much stuff happened where I just kind of lose track. You know, the phenomenon wears off and you go on to a new fighter.
Sure.
I gotta tell you, I've always been a fan of George ever since the first time I saw him fight. There's a lot of other guys that I really dig too that are real classy fighters. And way back in the day when the Iceman used to fight.
Yes.
God, Chuck, he was the man. He came to one of our concerts before, and I remember meeting him, and I was just standing there like, I'm scared. The first time in my life, I'm really scared standing in front of somebody. It was so awesome. So.
You mentioned Five Finger and your tour with Five Finger, your tour with Lamb of God. I think it's such a great idea and so smart for you to tour with a newer band, not that Lamb of God or Five Finger are newer, but you could go out with, you know, other thrash bands from the 80s. But I think it puts Megadeth on a completely different level when you're doing these co-headlining tours with bands, mm-hmm. you know, radio bands, shall we say, in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's smart. Is that the idea behind it, to kind of have different eras of fans come see you?
Well, we've been trying to do things a bunch of different ways. You know, we... 7 years ago, we made a management change to 5B, and we started with the Dave Mustaine Charm Offensive and rebuilding the Perfect Beast. So we knew basically where we were comfortably was playing in theaters and venues like that. And the goal was to eradicate the image or the impression that Megadeth was a theater band. Mm. And so we started working slowly but surely on ourselves, on our image, on our performances, on our song selections, on the merchandise that we have, the things that we talk about, the press, the interaction with the fans during the show, after the show, before the show, all that stuff, and really started taking this strategic approach to things, much like the predecessors we have that are still successful. A lot of times when you look at them, you think, wow, I wouldn't do that. Like, for example, Kiss. Kiss is a huge marketing business, and it's a brand. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say, you know, I wouldn't do that. But you know what? I think if you're talking about branding stuff, there may be some products that they've put out that I wouldn't put out. But I think the way that they've made themselves successful and popular for 50 years, whatever it is, they've had a plan. They've had a strategy. And that's something that we're really embracing right now, is thinking about longevity, thinking about how we can help other bands, because they're good promotion devices. Somebody goes out there and says, we run a great tour with Megadeth, and that's great press.
Yeah, it works. Last two questions for you, Dave. You've mentioned James and Lars a few times. I want to ask you what your favorite Cliff Burton story is, if there is one, because as the years go by, people still talk about Cliff, but very few knew him, and you were in a band, hung out. Is there a story about Cliff that stands up for you that makes you smile?
There's not a lot of stuff that comes to mind that, you know, when we did spend time together, the extent of the time that we spent was he would come and pick me up at this horrible place I was living at. Mark Whitaker, the guy that had done sound for the band at the time, James and Lars were living at his house in the Bay Area, and I lived way up in Walnut Creek. Cliff would pick me up. We'd ride to rehearsal. We'd jam. We'd ride back. He'd drop me off. And that was it. Didn't see him very much. We would drink at rehearsal. He smoked pot, but he had commercial. And it was like homegrown stuff. It was really terrible, but he smoked pot. So the one thing that I remember most was the day that the Mechanics became the Four Horsemen. And we were at the rehearsal building, which was a garage at Mark Whitaker's house that we turned into a jam room, hung carpet inside, and we played there. And I went in there, and we'd been listening to Lynyrd Skynyrd, because Lynyrd Skynyrd was one of Cliff's favorite bands. We're playing the Mechanics, and Lars goes, man, we need to add this fucking slow part, man. I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, well, why would you put a slow part in Mechanics, you know? Because I wrote it after watching that movie with Charles Bronson, the killer that was called The Mechanic, right?
Oh, okay.
And I worked at a gas station, so I kind of melded the two ideas together. And so I thought, all right, and I played dun 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 dun. The muscle shows they love the governor.
Sweet home Alabama.
Right. So Lars goes, that's brilliant. And I felt like saying, well, the Van Zandt seemed to think so. Or maybe Rossington's or Collins, one of those guys, whoever wrote the song. So he left it in the song. And I thought, oh, my God, Lars. It was funny to me.
The rest is history. Last question for you, Dave. Is there a song or a solo that stands out in the sick, the dying, and the dead? I know it's hard because they're all your children, but is there one that stands out for you today that you like the best?
God dang it. You would have to say that. I'm on the spot. There's so many that I love. Night Stalker has got some rad shredding in it.
Yeah.
Probably Night Stalker, because that's the fastest song we've done in a very long time, if ever.
Super fast.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great record, man. I really enjoy it. It's almost, I really enjoyed Dystopia, but I think this one is better.
Thank you.
On early listen. So it's great talking to you, Dave.
Me too.
Hopefully we get a chance to see each other again sooner than later. 6 years is too long.
Yeah, it has been too long.
Cheers, man. I'll see you on the road somewhere. Thanks, dude.
You got it, buddy. Be good. See you later, dude.